This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You've heard our expeditions down those exotic foreign rivers, the Volga, the Congo, the Mekong, stories full of local color and history. Well, today, a journey down a river closer to home, New Jersey's Passaic River. The Passaic, once at the heart of America's Industrial Revolution, is now the subject of a difficult environmental cleanup effort. Layers of pollutants sit at the bottom of the lower end of the river, and it could take years to rid the Passaic of dangerous chemicals with a price tag in the billions.
NPR's Art Silverman decided to find out how the Passaic got so polluted. Before he got underway, he sought advice from a veteran river explorer, NPR's Ophabia Quist Arkton, who traveled down Africa's Congo.
What can you tell me for my river trip? What should I keep in mind as I go?
Well, your Passaic River may not be as majestic, as fabled, and as celebrated as the Congo, but every river has a story to tell. Let the river tell you its story. It will.
Okay, but before I can listen to my river, I have to find out where it actually starts. And that's not easy.
Do you think this is it?
This is definitely it. This is it.
This is about, what, 5 feet even? 4 or 5 feet across?
4 or 5 feet across, maybe 6 or 8 inches deep, with a nice, slow, steady flow.
This is Sally Rubin. She's showing me the headwaters of the 90-mile Passaic River. Turns out Mile Zero is behind a high school in the town of Mendham, New Jersey.
And when you get further downstream and you see Newark and we go out on the river on a boat, you know, where it is navigable, try to remember what it looked like up here because it'll be very different.
I know that lower river she's talking about. That's the Passaic I'm used to glancing down at from the New Jersey Turnpike or an Amtrak train. For the first 5 miles, Sally Rubin travels with me along the Passaic. She explains that runoff from roads and parking lots is starting to pollute the river.
And the water from the road goes down these cute little storm drains, and you say, oh, where does the water go? It doesn't go away. There is no away.
Rubin's the executive director of the Great Swamp Watershed Association. The swamp is a national wildlife refuge. The Passaic passes through it about 10 miles from the headwaters. And leaving that swamp, you'd think the river is unspoiled. It could be the same river that inspired John McNabb to write a poem about it back in 1890, The Song of the Passaic.
And in the rise, the light and glow of grand old rivers in their flow, from distant hills through dales and leas, the fair Passaic seeks the sea.
And in the rise, the light and glow of grand old rivers in their flow, from distant hills through dales and
I was hoping to find indigenous music as I traveled along the Passaic. No luck. Instead, I asked this band called the Fountains of Wayne to perform that old poem as a song. The band, by the way, borrowed its name from a store that stood not far from the Passaic River. But as I traveled along the river, I heard no one singing about it, only people fretting about it.
I was haunted by the Passaic River.
Mary Bruno. Like me, she grew up along the Passaic. She writes about it in her book, This American River, From Paradise to Superfund. She has one big question for the river to answer.
What happened to you? That river that I grew to know as I grew up, it wasn't always dirty and oily and scary. It was beautiful, and it was lush, and it was filled with life.
Now I'm more than 50 miles from the headwaters, seeing evidence of abuse piling up along the river. I followed the twists and turns of the Passaic and have come to Little Falls, New Jersey.
Over there you got some styrofoam whatchamacallit thing.
This is my river guide.
My name is Wheeler Antabanez.
He's come along to point out the damage done to the Passaic.
So you got a Home Depot orange bucket sitting on top of the falls.
Nice, it looks like it's not moving either.
Yeah, the water's not that high. So, and over there you can see the slick of green algae. You see the glinting in the sun of many cans and bottles and balls, and there's another bucket.
Wheeler's real name is Matt Kent. He's a 33-year-old river rat with a perverse love of the Passaic River.
It takes a certain type of person to love the Passaic River, and I guess I embody that person. I like the Passaic River because it's abandoned. It's my river now. It's my territory.
5 miles further along, to Totowa, New Jersey, office parks, highways surround the Passaic. Down on the riverbank, I find Mark Greco fishing.
There is some nice fish in here.
There's a ban on eating fish from the lower Passaic River, but Greco isn't worried. He's not fishing for food. He's fishing for sport.
My grandfather used to drive his car on this river frozen when it would freeze. He used to drive his station wagon and take us in the car with him on the river. My grandfather was a gangster.
About 70 meandering miles from where it began, at Paterson, New Jersey, the Passaic becomes spectacular. The Great Falls of the Passaic, a 77-foot-deep cataract, nature's gift to New Jersey. And New Jersey has given much back to the falls.
And if you look below us here, you'll see rippling sewage froth on the surface of the water. And when it goes over the falls, all the sewage gets stirred up and it turns nice and creamy. Looks like chocolate milk. You almost want to drink it.
No natural wonder in America has played a greater role in shaping our history.
This is Leonard Zaks, born and raised here in the city of Paterson. He helped get this area declared a national park. In these foul waters, there's a lot of history. It all grew out of a lunchtime outing a long time ago.
One day during the Revolutionary War, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, and the Marquis de Lafayette picnicked by the Great Falls of the Passaic.
Ron Chernow. He wrote a biography of Alexander Hamilton.
We don't know whether at that moment Hamilton had a vision of America's industrial future, but he certainly knew that water was the electricity of the early Industrial Revolution, and that every day up to 2 billion gallons poured over that very scenic bend in the Passaic River. So I like to imagine that as he was looking up at that water plunging 70 feet to the river bottom, that he could see it spinning the blades of turbines and water wheels.
Paterson was once known as Silk City, and a few blocks from the Great Falls, there's this working loom in the Paterson Museum. When Alexander Hamilton became the first U.S. Treasury Secretary, he pushed a plan that turned this spot into America's first manufacturing city free from dependence on Europe, all due to the Great Falls. Hundreds of locomotives were built here. The first true motorized submarine was built here and tested in the Passaic River. And Samuel Colt made America's first repeating revolver at Paterson.
We are at the Colt Mill Complex, which is one of the worst spots along the Passaic River.
We go down a hill behind a homeless people's encampment to find the decaying structure where Colt made his guns. It's surrounded by brush and weeds and littered with syringes.
I find a lot of people living around here, spray painting the walls, and I find it to be one of the most interesting spots, even though it's one of the most dangerous spots.
Civic boosters hope tourists will overlook Paterson's present and come to the city to see its history and contemplate the role the Passaic once played. But some local residents are less enthusiastic about the river.
People themselves in Paterson, they really don't give two They'll dump bodies, they'll dump anything in there.
Sunny Mir strolls on a sidewalk not far from the Passaic.
Every time I look at it, it's like, it's sad. You go to like upstate New York, you see their rivers, it's all clean, nice. Over here, it looks like you touch it, you probably get AIDS or something on it.
The lower river is a victim of 200 plus years of industrialization and urbanization.
Rick Barrett, director of the Passaic River Institute, at Dundee Dam, almost 80 miles downstream from where I started. Barrett knows what's in the Passaic River and studies it, and it's not pretty.
Mercury, lead, PCBs, arsenic, DDT,
polyaromatic hydrocarbons,
dibenzofuran,
anthracene,
benzopyrene,
ricine, fluoranthine, fluorine, naphthalene.
Ready. Row.
These people are members of the Nereid Rowing Club in the town of Rutherford.
Let her run!
Despite what's in the water, high school crew teams and several rowing clubs use the Passaic. A century ago, you might have found people out on islands picnicking on a Sunday afternoon. Children once swam the river. Now to the last stretch of the river, Newark. In the 1960s, there was a plant here that produced the Passaic's worst waste product.
During the Vietnam War, 10 million gallons of Agent Orange were spread over the jungle foliage to take the leaves off.
18 to 20 million gallons of chemical herbicides were dropped on Vietnam. Key component, dioxin.
Dioxin is the most dangerous poison made by man.
Right behind me right now is the Diamond Shamrock, former Diamond Shamrock Chemical Company.
Captain Billy Sheehan of the Passaic River Patrol. He welcomes me aboard his boat near the mouth of the river. He shows me where Agent Orange was once made and where an effort to clean up its waste product is going on.
Behind that 8-foot thick enclosure is literally tons of dioxin-laden debris.
The entire lower 17 miles of the river is a Superfund site. Poison clings to the bottom and has to be dug out and contained. we pass a residential area called the Ironbound. During the era when Agent Orange was made here, the waste product became airborne.
Imagine the horror in the Ironbound community when people woke up, looked out their window, and saw people in Tyvek suits with gloves and respirators vacuuming the streets.
There could have been more care used.
Michael Turner. He speaks for the company that inherited responsibility for cleaning up this mess. But he points out that it wasn't just Agent Orange that ruined the Passaic River.
This whole area here was used as an enormous, like, industrial park. And, you know, unfortunately, you also have people whose neighborhoods are involved here, too. And it was all, they all worked here, and everyone benefited from the economic activity. It's just now there's a lot of people, including us, that have a responsibility to address the river and find ways to restore it.
The Passaic River has had a horrible reputation.
That's Newark Mayor Cory Booker. His city is finishing a park on the banks of the Passaic.
We're trying to bring our city back to the river. It was the butt of jokes in terms of its pollution to now something that's going to become, again, a source of life and light and excitement in our city.
I like the river the way it is. It's everyone else that wants to change it.
That's Wheeler, our river guide. He has his doubts about the future of the Passaic River.
If you come down here enough and you listen to what the river's telling you, she is crying out to be saved. And that's, I think, why people have devoted their lives to it. I just think it's unfortunate because I don't think they have a chance in hell of ever cleaning this river, you know what I mean?
Well, as I come to the end of my river journey, I realize the legacy of abusing the Passaic runs back 200 years. The story of the river mirrors the progress and the carelessness of an entire nation.
Until it's slow and lazy tide, or flows its banks on either side, and vast expanse of wastelands fill.
Art Silverman, NPR News.
The fair Passaic seeks the sea. The fair Passaic seeks the sea. Bum, 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 bum. Oh. Bum, 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 bum.
If you want to see what the Passaic River looks like today, check out our video of Art Silverman's journey down his Jersey Shore. That's at npr.org.
You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Used to be, if you wanted to talk to your computer, first you had to speak to it for hours at a time, pausing between each word to train this box to understand you. And then what? Well, use it to write your novel by speaking instead of typing. In those days, speech recognition required, you know, maybe it might flub one word in 10. It was almost faster to type it if you wanted to get it really accurate. In those days, we're talking about the long time ago of maybe 10 years. But now speech recognition is really starting to come into its own. You can talk to your car's GPS. You can get automatic captions to YouTube videos. Or maybe you've tried doing a Google voice search on your smartphone. I've tried this many times, and I am constantly amazed about what this understands, even foreign language words, with all that, without all that painstaking one-on-one training. So how does it work? How do these algorithms actually figure out that you said frying pan instead of flying lamb? And are there any similarities between how computers are learning to understand speech and how we humans do it? Are computers processing words and sentences just like our brains do? Maybe they've copied how that. Well, that's what we're going to talk about. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guests. Mike Cohen heads up Google's research in speech technology. He's based at the Googleplex in Mountain View, California. He joins us from a studio there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Sheila Bloomstein is a professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological science at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. She joins us from a campus there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Bloomstein.
Thanks so much. Welcome to me. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much. Mike, just how does Google speech recognition technology work? How do you get this to recognize the speech so well?
Well, the most fundamental idea behind the approach that we take is that it's data-driven. And by that, what I mean is we feed our machines many, many, many examples of people speaking, many different people speaking. And based on that, we have algorithms that build a model, and it's fundamentally a statistical model. So we build a statistical model of the language. That model has information about the basic acoustics or sound units of the language, like how the ums and the ahs and the buzz and the puzz and so on in the language are produced. Mm-hmm. It has information about the words and how they're pronounced, like economics might be spoken economics or economics. And it has information about the word sequences, the phrases and sentences that tend to happen right in the language.
So you're not building rules of grammar in English. You're using basically crowdsourcing, listening to people say them, and sort of self-correcting over time. More people talk about it, the more you learn how it works.
Yeah, that's fundamentally correct. It would be probably extremely difficult, if not impossible, to try to explicitly program all this knowledge, and we don't really understand all of the minute details. Uh-huh. So instead, we get lots and lots and lots of data, and we build these big models, statistical models of the speech,
right,
based on all that data.
So give me an idea. When I ask Google to find me something in Google search, what goes on? Walk us through some of the steps that goes on in the process of recognition there.
Okay. So first, the speech comes in. We figure out where speech started and ended, and we do something called feature extraction. Basically, it's something like a spectral analysis, or trying to find what are all of the frequency components, the basic features that make up the sound. Then we take that and we feed it to the model that I just described.
Right.
So it's this big statistical model of the acoustics, the words, the grammar in terms of how words are put together. And fundamentally, speech recognition is finding a best path, a best matching path through that model, and that's what the speech recognizer guesses was said.
Mm-hmm. Is there a dictionary it goes to find words that best fit the question I'm asking?
Yeah, so one of the components of that big statistical model is a lexicon, and it's a list of all of the words in the language and a specification of how they're pronounced. Mm-hmm. So, for example, economics and economics as
right
two pronunciations.
Right. Sheila Bloomstein, tell us what happens in the brain when we hear someone speaking. Is it this similar to what Google is doing in voice recognition?
Well, in many ways it is. Our idea and the notion is that acoustic waveform comes in, and again, just as Mike said, it's transformed into a frequency, temporal, amplitude domain, and that in turn maps on to another level of abstraction, individual sound segments like putuka, badaga, iau. Those in turn map on to words like cat, dog, a mental lexicon, as we would call it, and that in turn maps on to meaning. But broadly speaking, what's really important is that the system is always making probability guesses, using all the information it can at all points in time that it can.
You mean so I'm sorry, go ahead. You're going to give me an example.
No, go ahead.
No, give me an example of what you mean.
Well, an example would be, for example, if I say, let's say I say C versus Sue as an example. When you say Sue, you round your lips. When you round your lips, that lengthens your vocal tract, which mm-hmm lowers the frequencies. So it turns out that we don't perceive individual sounds, but we use all the information to tell us that what's coming. So S followed by E versus S followed by U is very different. If you just say S and S like that, can you hear the difference in the frequency?
Yeah.
S, S.
Yeah.
We use that. Another example would be that when we the sounds map onto words, we know what are the possible consonants and the possible vowels that can fit. So, for example, truck. TR starts a word, but it doesn't end any word. So we know where the beginning of a word is. So all the time we're making hypotheses about what the possible word may be, and then we slowly but surely, as information comes in, we break it down into smaller pieces.
Uh-huh. Is this how babies are learning when they learn vocabulary?
Well, we think so. I mean, one advantage the baby has is that the baby appears to be born with essentially the building blocks for the sounds of language. So infants as young as a few days old perceive all the sounds, potential sounds of all languages in the beginning. And then slowly, as they're exposed to their native language, they actually reduce their ability to map onto the language. However, they're also very much aware and are sensitive to the probabilities of what sounds can go with what. So again, the baby might hear truck, and in English, TR can begin a word but never ends a word. So that gives them information about where the beginning of a word might be.
Interesting.
Or milk. LK ends a word, but there's no information, or we don't use LK at the beginning of a word. So that the baby uses those kinds of probabilities in order to be able to map it onto what is the word truck, what is the word milk, and is it a word?
Mm-hmm.
How
Mike,
do I...
Yeah, Mike, yeah. Does Google use sort of the same kind of recognition?
In a certain sense, yes, but in a certain sense, no. So it's not like we explicitly give our machine rules about where an LK might happen, but those aspects of the language are learned in a statistical sense from all of the data that we feed
mm-hmm. it. Do the algorithms sometimes disagree with each other? For example, the lower level processor says, I know I heard this sound, and the higher level processor says, but that sentence doesn't make sense if you put those together.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. In fact, one of the core principles of how we do this is all of the knowledge sources exert their influence simultaneously. So our knowledge about the acoustics or the basic sounds like the ums, ahs, and mm-hmm. buzz, our knowledge about the pronunciation of words, our knowledge about grammar in a statistical sense, what words tend to follow what other words, all gets brought to bear simultaneously. So if somebody said something, let's say the recognizer just recognized the dog, and maybe it's a little unsure, did it say the dog ran, or did the person say the dog tan? If there's a lot of acoustic ambiguity there, then the language model, the piece that says, hey, it's way more likely after the dog to have the word ran than tan, having learned right. that from lots of examples, that will influence the recognition search.
Mm-hmm. Do you folks in the computer world actually look at how the brain works and try to design a computer about that, or do these speech recognition processes just resemble each other because we've all arrived at that's the best solution independently?
Right. It's a little of each. You know, we're certainly influenced by things that we've learned from linguists and neuroscientists, but fundamentally, our goals are engineering goals. We're trying to figure out how, with modern-day computers, to build the very best, most accurate, most useful systems for end users. And so, fundamentally, right. what we're guided by is new algorithms that gradually work better and better.
Let me see if I can get a quick question in before the break. Mike Ford in North Carolina. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, question. As you can tell, I'm not originally from North Carolina, so I was wondering how they handle dialect.
Yeah. How do accents and dialects? Good question.
Yep.
How do you do
okay.
that?
So that goes back to the fact that we learn from examples. So when we train our recognition system or feed it examples, we try to get speech from literally millions of people speaking, and it has to include, you know, people like me from Brooklyn who do, you know, park a car, and other people from other parts of the country. And so it has to cover dialects, it has to cover voice types, it has to cover, you know, obviously both genders, it has to cover all the different kinds of noise conditions and everything else, so that as long as it's represented in our training set, therefore gets into the statistics of our statistical model, we should be able to handle it.
Uh-huh. Is there anything you need to do to work out any future that we should see better voice recognition?
Well, there's a lot of active research. Mm-hmm. A lot of the research has to do with getting more data, finding ways to use more data to train these systems. And as we get more data, the question becomes, how do we make the model bigger or richer in an appropriate way so it becomes a better model of the language.
All right.
And that research is at many levels.
Thank you both for taking time to be with us. Mike Cohen heads up Google's research in speech technology at Googleplex, and Sheila Bloomstein, professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological science at Brown University. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a short...
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're
going to
take a short break. We're going to come back and change gears. And we're going to still talk about technology, the Xbox Kinect. How does it know what you're doing? You're not holding on to any of its tools. So we'll try to dissect that one also. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
When commentator Andrei Kudrescu stepped away from his teaching job, he envisioned a new idyllic chapter in his life. He was wrong.
I had this crazy idea, not my first or my last, that one day when I retired from my more or less regular job, I would reread all the books I once loved, and I'd also read all the books I never had time for. And now that I retired from my more or less regular job, I find not only that I have no time to read, I don't seem to have time for anything. And so I think I discovered something. Hundreds of jobs that you never did when you had the more or less regular job are waiting patiently for you to retire, and the minute you do, they pounce on you. People you haven't seen in years appear on the phone, on Facebook, and in person, and your guilt for neglecting them more acute. Things fall apart faster, and fixing them takes longer. Requests for volunteer work jump out of the maybe basket and squeeze your heart. Sentiments you never thought you had seize you with some urgency, demanding you do something about this or that lost cause or hopeless situation. And all the books you meant to reread, and all the books you planned to read, turn out to be about all those things you neglected to do for all those years when you had a more or less regular job. And if you did reread or read them, they will make you feel twice as guilty, and you'll end up doing twice as much. And then you realize that what you had before you retired wasn't a job, but a wonderful jar full of excuses, now broken. So get ready to go to work, pal. And so I am. I'm taking all those books to Goodwill.
Andrei Kudrescu's latest book is called The Poetry Lesson.
Many of the Republicans in the next Congress were elected or re-elected on a promise to repeal the health care law. The issue is popular with Republican voters, but some traditional Republican allies are pushing back. NPR's Julie Robner explains why.
Incoming House Speaker John Boehner told Fox News earlier this month he'll do whatever it takes to eliminate the new health law.
This health care bill will ruin the best health care system in the world, and it will bankrupt our country.
So you'll take a vote on repealing it?
We are going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with common sense reforms that'll bring down the cost of health insurance.
So what do you...
Now, 88% of Republican voters polled on Election Day agree with that goal, but a lot of key players in the health care industry don't. Rich Umdenstock, for example, is president and CEO of the American Hospital Association.
Doing away with this would certainly be the wrong thing. People have been gearing up for some time, well before this actual bill got passed, to make these changes locally and have invested a lot.
And it's not just hospitals. Employers, particularly large employers, have already put a lot of time, effort, and money into implementing the parts of the law that have already taken effect. Helen Darling heads the National Business Group on Health, which represents many of the Fortune 100 corporations. She says just the possibility that the law will be repealed or substantially changed is a serious problem.
It takes a long lead time to execute any policy. So at this point, having a lot of uncertainty and policy volatility really work against helping us to move towards solving the problems of the country.
Which is not to say that the healthcare industry loves the law. No segment of the industry got everything it wanted, and everyone is busy lobbying for something to be changed, she says.
There are plenty of opportunities for improvement, fine-tuning, and actually adding some significant enhancements, especially in controlling costs.
The health insurance industry wants to make more than just fine-tuning changes. It's been among the most outspoken critics of the measure. But even insurers haven't come out in favor of scrapping the whole law and starting over, particularly not when it stands to get millions of new customers. Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for America's Health Insurance Plans.
We look forward to working with both parties to minimize coverage disruptions caused by the new law and to make health care coverage more affordable for working families and small businesses.
So what's going on? Are Republicans being abandoned by their usual allies in the business community? Not exactly, says Jonathan Oberlander, a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Usually we think of the healthcare industry as being in alliance with the Republicans in opposing more government intervention in the health system. But you have to ask, why did the healthcare industry support the reform law in the first place?
The reason, he says, is because the more people there were without health insurance, that number is now more than 50 million, the more threatened the industry got financially. In other words, its entire business model was threatening to fall apart.
The healthcare industry needs paying customers and insured customers to make their business model work. To the extent that Republicans push repeal, they're threatening the bottom line in some sense of the healthcare industry.
And to the extent the health industry perceives the new law as better than the world as it was before, he says, expect industry players to oppose repeal strenuously.
Because they're putting so many resources into it, a repeal in that sense represents a threat to them because they're already spending lots of money getting ready for the law. So if you're talking about rolling the law back, that's a blow to their future, but it also represents a loss of all the resources they've pumped into it right now into getting ready for it.
Which leaves Republicans with a dilemma of their own. Please their voters or please some of their biggest donors. When it comes to health care, they may not be able to do both. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The head of the Fox News Channel has apologized to a Jewish civil rights group for using the term Nazis to describe NPR executives. Here's NPR's David Folkenflik.
You think that whole Juan Williams flap couldn't get any more contentious? It just did. Fox News chief Roger Ailes spoke to a reporter for the Daily Beast website. He ripped NPR for terminating Williams for remarks on Fox News about Muslims. NPR said the termination followed a pattern of inappropriate remarks. Ailes rewarded Williams with a $2 million, three-year contract. But in the piece published Thursday, Ailes spoke of NPR executives, saying, quote, "They are, of course, Nazis. They have a kind of Nazi attitude. They are the left wing of Nazism. These guys don't want any other point of view." In a letter Thursday to a top official of the Anti-Defamation League, Ailes apologized. He said he should have instead said, "nasty, inflexible bigot." But Ailes also wrote he was upset at two rabbis who complained about Fox host Glenn Beck for repeatedly comparing his own rhetorical targets to Nazis. The spat came the same day as an effort by conservatives in the House of Representatives to force a vote on stripping federal funding for NPR. NPR receives a sliver of money from the federally financed Corporation for Public Broadcasting for its own operations each year, though public radio member stations rely on that money more heavily. The effort to even have a formal vote on the funding failed, but a new Congress takes over in January, and when it does, the House will be controlled by a resurgent Republican majority. One final note, both NPR and Fox News say Ailes has not apologized to NPR executives themselves for calling them Nazis. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
The U.S. women's national soccer team may not get the headlines it did in the days of Mia Hamm, but the Americans remain an international power and a favorite to win the 2011 Women's World Cup next summer in Germany, if, that is, they can clear an unexpected roadblock. Sportswriter Stefan Fatsis joins us now, as he does most Fridays, to talk about this and other soccer matters. Welcome, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
And that roadblock is actually qualifying for the tournament, something that's never been a problem for U.S. women's soccer before. What's going on?
Well, the U.S. hasn't won every big event. 3 out of 4 Olympic gold medals, 2 out of 5 World Cups. But getting there has never been an issue. And then 2 weeks ago, the U.S. was upset in the semifinals of regional qualifying by Mexico, to whom it had never lost in 25 games. So now the United States has to play Italy in a 2-game series for a spot in the World Cup. The first game is in Padua, Italy, tomorrow at 10:30 Eastern. You can watch it online at ESPN3.com.
Now, meanwhile, the U.S. men's national team played a friendly, an exhibition game in South Africa this week. Friendlies usually don't merit a conversation, certainly not here, but this one did because of a couple of players who debuted for the U.S. Tell us about them.
They debuted and they combined for the game's only goal, Juan Agudelo and Mikel Discarrude. Agudelo is a striker, just 17 years old, born in Colombia, raised in New Jersey, already plays in Major League Soccer, and he became the youngest scorer in modern American men's history. Now, Discarrude, his nickname is Mix, is a 20-year-old midfielder. He's got an American mother, a Norwegian father, and the significant thing here is that by playing a game for the men's team, it's now going to be difficult for them to change their minds and decide to represent Norway or Colombia in the future on the soccer field.
Now, you mentioned Major League Soccer. Major League Soccer's championship game is on Sunday, and I understand that David Beckham will not be participating.
No, he will not. The glamorous names of the league, Beckham, the U.S. national team star Landon Donovan, both of whom play for the Los Angeles Galaxy, the French import Thierry Henry, who joined the New York Red Bulls this season and had a very positive impact on the league. Those teams were favorites, but they were eliminated in the playoffs. The finalists are going to be FC Dallas and the Colorado Rapids. They are original teams from the MLS's start back in 1996. One of them will win its first title.
And you've been optimistic about Major League Soccer. You still feel that way?
Yeah, I do. The fan base has been stable. You've got more and more of these beautiful soccer-only stadiums being built. The league's going to add two more teams next season, the Portland Timbers and the Vancouver Whitecaps. They'll be instant rivals with names that date back to the old North American Soccer League in the 1970s. And I think that's a smart thing because MLS doesn't take advantage enough of the richer-than-you'd-think history of soccer in America. Instead, there's still this infatuation with Europe, and we saw that this week in a faux Euro name change for the MLS team in Kansas City. The Wizards are now Sporting Kansas City, like the famous Sporting Lisbon team. I think we can do without that.
Finally, let's turn overseas. FIFA, soccer's international governing body, this week released its evaluations of the bids to host the World Cup in 2018 and 2022. The U.S. is bidding for the 2022 World Cup. What's the word?
Well, FIFA loved the important stuff, the stadiums, the infrastructure, the ability to sell way more tickets than the competitors here. Qatar, Japan, South Korea, and Australia. The bigger problem might be reports of a deal between delegates representing Qatar and Spain and Portugal, which have a joint bid for 2018 to vote for each other. FIFA's ethics committee said it found no evidence of collusion, after which FIFA's leader, Sepp Blatter, said, "You cannot avoid collusion." So go figure that one out. FIFA's ethics committee did at least suspend two voters who were caught on video seeking bribes for their votes from reporters posing as lobbyists for the U.S. bid. So this should be interesting. The vote is December 2nd.
Okay. Thank you, Stefan.
Thanks, Robert.
Stefan Fatsis joins us on Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. You can hear more of him on Slate.com's sports podcast. Hang up and listen.